Yeah, our face shroud covers your mouth, and then you have goggles on, so you really have no, you shouldn't have any unprotected skin. It should all be covered. But it does, it limits your ability to breathe. It's hot, it's smoky, it's not ideal conditions. And then you add the heat and all the gear you're carrying. If they're putting stringing hose out, we call it plumbing the line, you're going to have another 75 pounds or so on your back that you're carrying.
Thanks for pressing play. I'm Christopher Lockhead, and this is Follow Your Different. We're a dialogue podcast, the opposite of your standard interview. We aspire to have real conversations with people who honed what makes them unique and turned it into a superpower. We're sponsored by our friends at Oracle NetSuite. Learn to turbocharge the growth of your business at netsuite.com/different. On this episode, you'll learn what it means to take action when lives and billions are at stake. Your own ideas of heroism and preparation will be expanded, and you'll gain insights into leadership that you can apply directly to your own life. Recently, as you know, we suffered the deadliest, most destructive wildfire in all of California's history. Today, we talk to my friend, one of the men I respect the most, retired Battalion Chief T.J. Welsh. He gives an insider's view of how 5,000 firefighters can spring into action in a matter of hours, how multiple California fire agencies mobilized together to stop what can only be called a raging terror. TJ has a storied background as a firefighting leader. He gives us a riveting and detailed look at wildfires, what it's like to be one of the commanding officers charged with leading this kind of massive effort, and the surprising role that California inmates play in fighting fire. For more on TJ's background and the key takeaways from this episode, go to lockhead.com and check out the show notes. Also, while you're there, and most importantly, we've put together some links for you. If you want to make a donation to help the victims of these horrible fires, we'll point you to the right places. That's on Lockhead, LOCHHEAD.com. Now, hey ho, let's go.
Redwood, when it reaches a certain temperature, it can withstand a lot of heat, but then it just explodes. I mean, it's truly an explosive sound.
And excuse my ignorance, yeah. But that's different than other trees?
Then some maybe other pines and stuff will ignite easier, but I was pretty naive to all this because I'd really only been to, you know, a few brush fires and mostly structure fires. So that was my first eye-opening to it. It was years later where I went to work for a city municipal department, Dublin San Ramon Fire Department, which later became Alameda County. So I spent my whole career at those agencies, but we would just go to many, many brush fires. In fact, the Altima, which is all grass, we'd go out there and burn a couple thousand acres and be home in time for dinner. So you become kind of a use of that. But there's a level of being a chief officer where you can go out of county, we call it, when you go outside of your district to some of these wildland fires. And I had been sent out to a couple of wildland fires, Malibu in 93, which was a pretty significant, much like the Malibu fire they recently had, but maybe even a little more devastating, lots of homes lost. Not so many lives, but lots of very expensive homes. But in those days, they pretty much took a city guys and put us in front of a house, a group of houses, and said, don't let it burn, do all the best you can do. And we would just kind of sit and wait for the fire to come and then do our thing. It wasn't until the late 90s where they started making more use of us instead of let us sit around, where we actually went into the timber or the brush area, and they started having us cut line or put preventative line in where we try to stop it. And do another type of operation. So in the late 90s, this was my moment where it kind of changed my perspective of my role as a chief officer. We call it the strike team leader, going out and overseeing some of these engine companies in the wildland arena. It was a but it turned out being a little over 100,000 acre fire, which at the time was the largest fire in California, but it was in the...
What year would that have been?
I want to say it was 97. It was called the Fork Fire. I should remember. It's in Clear Lake area.
Isn't it crazy that it feels like every year we've had the largest fire in California history?
And they're expanding. So that was the largest fire in California at that time. That was 100,000 acres. So here we are today, you know, approaching 200,000 acres.
Is that what the campfire?
The campfire is, it's not quite there. It's, I think, 160,000 acres, 157,000 acres right in that area.
And frame that in my head. Like, how many baseball fields is that? Or, like, how should I wrap my brain around the size of that many, 150,000 acres, pushing up on 200?
Well, they say an acre is about the size of a football field. So, it's close proximity. So, that's when we tell our new firefighters to give a rule of thumb, a measure of fire on how the size of it. We say a rule of thumb would be football fields close to an acre. So that's kind of the mindset we set. So you can, that's a lot of football fields.
So but, that Butte fire, that camp fire.
Right.
Is 150,000 you said?
I think it's 157 last I heard. Right. Something like that.
150,000. Almost 160,000 football field. Yeah. I can't wrap my head around how much land that is.
Yeah, it's hard, and especially when you put in perspective how many residences there were, the timber that's involved, and how explosive it, and how quickly it really burns. So they were, I think I heard they were estimating it was burning a couple football fields per second, which you obviously are not going to outrun, and hence the loss of life we had.
Now, how is it that a fire moves that fast? I heard that in the news recently, and I don't ever remember as sort of a generic civilian understanding the speed with which these fires move.
Right. Well, there's a lot of different reasons for it, and I'm not a specialist in that area. I've had some training in it, the basic training needed to do my jobs, but when you look at grass fires, like the Altamont area that we have, you know, up in that central Tracy area, which is, we call those 1 hour fuels, and they're called 1 hour fuels because within an hour they can go from wet to dry or dry to wet. And they change rather rapidly. When you get to timber, they're talking about 1,000 hour fuels or 10,000 hour fuels. Well, the problem with the timber is it takes a long time for it to dry out to become dry, but then it, consequently, it takes a long time for them to get the moisture back in them. And so we've had this drought for so many years, and a lack of clearing the timber, the down timber, the bad timber. Timber is the forest products. There's just a lot of rules and regulations around that. So they like to just keep the dead timber falls and they leave it where it's at. So that just fuels the timber that's still alive. But that live fuel, even though it's a live, large piece of timber, it's dry in the senses that we've had this lack of water for so many years, this drought situation. So they reach a certain temperature and then they just catch on fire, and that heat, radiant heat, puts off more radiant heat, and it just expands, especially if it's on a hillside. So it just, this radiation heat just causes the fire just to explode. And this is what I was saying about my fire, first big fire, timber fire. First, the fire came through the crowning of the timber. It was so hot that it was actually, the fire was 200 feet above the canopy of a forest, if you can imagine that.
So it's 200 feet above the top of the trees.
Right. Which is something that's hard to imagine unless you've been in it. And once we got through that component, well, then the understory, the brush underneath burned through. So your fire was on multiple fronts at multiple times. There was no time really to rest. And my crews were spread out over a couple of miles of distance, protecting structures primarily, but there was no way to get to them. There's no way to drive and say, okay, I've had enough. I'm going to get on the road and pack out of here. Our engine companies were stuck where they're at. So,
'cause you were surrounded by fire.
And heavy timber, and the brush was so overgrown, the roads were so overgrown, it wasn't safe to get on the roads. So we had safety areas, safety zones, we call them, within their own little geographic areas they were signed off to. So it wasn't until the understory fire was in a situation where we had it in hand that we could actually check to make sure everyone was still alive, meaning our own fire people. So when I left that fire, I said, I'm not going to be so ignorant when I come to another wildland fire. The days of the city firefighters sitting in front of a house waiting for the fire to come with the hose line is gone. And now we just spend as much time out into the timber and cutting brush and fighting fires. We're just another resource for the wildland agencies to do that. So that was a moment. So
I hate to interrupt you, but let me make sure I understand. So in the past, there were the specialists in wildfires,
right,
and they brought you guys in and you protected structures and did things that the quote unquote city guys were more used to doing.
Right.
And over the course of your career, quote unquote city firefighters have had to be trained to get in the, right in the mix and do what the specialists do.
That's exactly right. And it's taken some time. And after that fire in the Fork fire I was telling you about, there's also a significant event that happened in 1995. It was called the Calabasas fire, in which a couple of city engines got burned over and we almost lost the lives of some firefighters. So because of that, we started doing training and set training requirements. And I became part of that at the state level to set training requirements for our folks, because it really was not fair to send our members out there unprepared for what they were going to have to be expected to accomplish.
So you ultimately became part of the group of firefighters and leadership who set the bar for the education, the training that was required for city firefighters to get trained up so that when they headed to one of these horrible wildfires, they knew what they needed to know.
That's right. To some extent, I don't want to try to say that we recreated anything, but what we did is we adopted the National Wildland Standard. It's a group called the National Wildland Coordinating Group, and we adopted their standard, but made that requirement for local firefighters that go out in that environment. They had to have the same level of training.
So if I'm a local firefighter here in the Santa Cruz area, I get trained in not just home fires and all the other things you guys do, car accidents. Of course, most of what you guys do is not fires, right?
Correct.
But I get trained in all of the things that a quote-unquote normal city firefighter would get trained in, and then I get this additional training, or is it a certain group, or how does it work?
Well, it's kind of a voluntary thing. So in order to participate in this, we call it mutual aid, and I'll just back. So mutual aid in the state of California is by far more advanced than any other mutual aid in the nation or the world, for that matter. There's no other state our country that can mobilize the amount of resources we can mobilize to a fire in the same amount of time.
So like with this Butte fire, how many firefighters are there?
Yeah. So, well, at the peak of it, it was a little over 5,000. And I could say within 8 hours of the fire, you could probably have 3,000 to 5,000 firefighters at that incident.
Within 8 hours of the fire starting, right, you could have 3,000 to 5,000 firefighters on the ground working.
At least, if not on the ground, ordered it en route. So we could easily have thousands there, depending on the location. Now, the campfire that we were talking about, which is up outside of Chico, Paradise, is an area that we can get a number of resources there rather quickly, which is mind-boggling. The problem is you have to be able to deploy those resources. And we saw this in the Oakland Hills fire that we had. And again, because it's of the location in the Bay Area, we had literally hundreds and thousands of engines showing up, but we didn't have the system in place really to get them deployed to the right houses, and they were just backed up on the freeway.
Back at the Oak. Do you remember what year that Oakland fire was? That big fire?
No, the earthquake was in 89, so it was It was in the 90s.
Yeah,
it's amazing how I can't remember that, and I was in the middle of it all, but. Those dates seem to slip by. Someone out there on the radio is yelling right now what the date is, I'm sure.
Yeah. And so these fires, when they get going, how long does it take for a fire to get moving where it's traveling football fields in seconds?
Well, it depends on a couple of things. Fuel type, grass can move in a couple, as soon as it ignites, it could burn football fields. The timber takes a little time, and the mid-brush, the brush in between the grass and the timber, can take a little bit of time. But the weather's a big driver and probably the primary factor, and that really is what prevents firefighters from doing their job, is depending on the weather, we sometimes just can't get in front of the fire. And so we have to think way in advance of the fire in order to try to stop it.
And way in advance means where the fire is likely to move?
Right. So if we can't get in the right on the fire line itself where the flames are 8, 10, 15, 20, 200 feet in the air, we're obviously not going to put our personnel right in front of it because they wouldn't be able to stop it. So we have to look at alternatives.
And there would be nothing they could do. They'd just be overtaken.
Right. And we bring aircraft in, but aircraft is limited. We bring dozers in and try to cut line ahead of it. There's a lot of resources we can use, but the tactics really depends on the topography, the lay of the land. Is the fire burning up a ridge and we can get on the ridge and try to put a line in? Or is it burning downhill and we're getting to a creek and maybe that is our moment? But believe it or not, if the wind is right, the fire burns downhill just as fast as it burns uphill sometimes, just because it can be driven by weather.
So wind direction is a very material factor.
Right. So all these things come into play, and it requires a lot of this basic knowledge. And that's why we now teach city, local government guys these basic components of how wildland fires operate. So they have the basic understanding. The thought of having Big Brother watching you, these wildland agencies out there thinking they know what's going on. They wouldn't put us in a spot that would get us in trouble, are long gone. So we have to educate ourselves now.
So with a huge fire like this camp fire we're having right now, what percentage of those firefighters, if there was 5,000 or so at the peak, TJ, what percentage of them would be specialists, Cal Fire resources who mostly do this,
right,
versus firefighters from local towns and cities around the state?
Well, I would just take an educated guess that well over 50% are local government agencies. The state doesn't have that many resources available to them. So out of the 5,000, I'd say at least 3,000 are local government, meaning they came from one of our neighborhood cities and towns and threw all their gear on a truck and drove up there.
Yeah.
So that component of it. So the biggest thing is trying to keep those people safe and have them educated and understanding what's going to happen. And, you know, we've come a long ways in the process. We learn a lot from the military, and yet the military sometimes learns a little bit from us. From the military, we learned this commander's intent or leader's intent, which is just task, purpose, and end state, meaning task, purpose, and end state. Those are the three
End state.
End state. I'll try to enunciate a little better. So those three
things. Some of us didn't go to school, so I need to make sure I get what you're saying.
Yeah, so just the basic understanding of when we show up, our task is to basically, we're going to say, okay, we want to keep the fire to a certain geographic area. That could be the task. The purpose, obviously, is to prevent harm from life and conserve property. And the end state should look like we've been able to contain it. And the reason we talk about this leader's and commander's intent, because when you mobilize that many resources that quickly, you can't go have a little discussion with each one of the members and say, okay, here's what I want you to do. They have to have somewhat of an understanding before you get there. And this is where I think it's phenomenal what we're able to do in the emergency services by bringing a group of people together. I mean, think of the business world. How could you bring all your background is in marketing, I know part of it. So all these marketers and try to accomplish a common goal without spending a day or 2 days or a week ahead of time discussing what those goals are. So it's amazing.
Just so you understand how big the delta is between your world and the business world that I understand, most companies, at least in the tech universe that I would be familiar with, by way of example, would do, they call them SKOs or SKOs, sales kickoffs.
Okay.
And they typically do it once a year. They bring the entire field organization together. You know, in a bigger company, it can be many thousands of people. And you have a 2 to 4 day event, typically. And it's training oriented. You get trained on new products and new sales techniques, and you know, you right. you get your comp plan for the year, and you get your territory for the year, and this kind of stuff. And everybody in a business context gets their marching orders. So if you're the head of sales, or you're the CEO of a company that has, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 people in the field, just to kind of get the similar size, to do what you're talking about, that is to say, how do we go out and win
right.
this year? They get together for sometimes, you know, 4 or 5 days.
And in your world, are you talking about one company or all?
Yeah. Yeah. No, so, that's just one company. They all work for one employer with right. one that rolls up to one CEO.
Yeah. So, and this is what's crazy is these are all different employers with different real purposes in their real life. Some are volunteers, some are maybe paid professionals. But
we have volunteers at these massive wildfires.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they're a big part of, especially in the area around Chico, there's a lot of volunteer fire departments that respond to it, and they operate just like a paid person. There's no difference.
And you don't treat them any different? Their skill level is no different?
No, not at all. In fact, sometimes maybe they're better equipped to do it. They have better knowledge because of local knowledge and expertise from being in that area. So sometimes they're... Just because of some of our members get paid and some are volunteers, it doesn't really differentiate the abilities that they're going to provide and what they can provide at the fire. So when you look at it from the aspect, you're taking different companies, different organizations from across the state, bringing together in one place within
a few hours. I would assume
we kind of have commonalities of because there's national standards for fire equipment. It doesn't mean everybody meets it. I've had water tenders, which is just a big water tank, that like a construction type water tank, that belonged to a volunteer fire department, show up with bald tires, baling wire holding it together, and a guy that didn't have a license to drive it. But unbeknownst to me until that time, CHP doesn't require any requirements when going code 3 to emergency. So they could operate the same level where our city department has really nice equipment, maintained equipment. So it comes from all different facets. But when you imagine you're taking all these different resources and trying to get them to accomplish one goal without the time really to explain to them, it's pretty amazing what they can accomplish when they get there. Now, we have a plan. We call it an incident action plan. And that plan is supposed to go to at least the strike team leader. We call it the division groups, where they have an understanding, and it has 8 really basic components that are important to us. Primarily, the objective is what we're supposed to accomplish is the biggest one. So it would, just like in business, we would like to know what objectives are we supposed to accomplish throughout the event. There's a safety plan that's a big part of that. And probably the primary safety component for our own personnel is a communications plan, that we have different communication, common communications, but we're not all on one channel, obviously, when you have that many people. So there's a couple of different components of it that we give out to these groups as they come in when time allows. But for the first, what we call initial attack, which is probably the first 8 hours to 24 hours, there's no incident action plan. It's not until a group of people, a team shows up and publishes that they actually get that plan. But once we get that plan, we kind of define what the boundaries are. Then we kind of have a common, set of goals to work towards.
And so if you think about a big fire like we've just had now, right. It breaks out, the news of it happens, the mobilization begins. Right. Is there one, I don't know, is it an incident commander, or is there leader who is ultimately the general or the right. CEO of that fire?
Yeah, that's a great question. So and maybe some fire guys may not even know this question. We do have one incident commander, but we do what are called unified command, meaning there could be multiple people speaking as incident commander, but they speak with one voice. In order to do that, they have to all agree to what is being stated. They all have to have a checkbook with them that they can write out of to meet those goals. So, for example, at the campfire, you have the local sheriff's department is part of that command post. The local fire department is part of that command post. Cal Fire is part of that command post. And the Forest Service, because it's burning in all their different areas. So they all have a chip in, into the game there. So
because some of it's federal land and some of it's private land and some of it's county land, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Now, the interesting thing is the Forest Service has a different mission than CAL FIRE does on a day-to-day basis. CAL FIRE's day-to-day mission is to extinguish fires. The Forest Service, their day-to-day mission is they manage fires, meaning they'll allow fires to burn. If it's a lightning strike fire, they may allow it to burn. They don't immediately extinguish it where CAL FIRE would. So while our day-to-day missions may differ, when that unified command group speaks, incident command, they speak as one voice. So they all come out with one voice.
So if I'm the Forest Service leader and I'm communicating from incident command, I'm the commander. And then if the local sheriff is communicating, he's the commander. It's sort of, we're passing the baton or how does it work?
No, it's just one voice. You stay in one room and you speak with one voice. You don't talk on behalf of the Forest Service. If you're the Forest Service person, you talk on behalf of unified command of that incident. So your goals will change and you sometimes have to compromise to meet the goals of the incident. And sometimes they don't change. Like in the Forest Service, they don't allow a lot in the wilderness areas, no wheeled vehicles, even during a fire. No dozers can't go up there. Fire engines can't go up there.
Why is that?
It's the Forest Service mission. That's their wilderness area, and that's what they hold by. So,
is it because it's too dangerous?
No, it's because they don't allow wheeled vehicles in the wilderness area ever, even for emergencies. They don't put wheeled vehicles in there. So you have to abide by these certain rules. So you may have that in the wilderness or in the Forest Service area of the fire, but when you get to the city, then it changes. So you kind of have to know the basis. And this incident action plan that we develop or is developed at the incident kind of goes over those rules. Once you get there, you kind of understanding it. And there's maps that go along with the wilderness area. And then those rules change based on the geographic area that you're in. The other part of that is in the wilderness area, there's typically, there are some structures, obviously, but they've been there for a long time, but there's typically not a lot of structures or at least dwellings and homes in the wilderness area. So for that reason, it's not as significant to us as when we get into the city and we're trying to save lives and property.
Yeah. And so what's it like as a firefighter on the ground when you show up at a fire like this campfire and you have to go, you get your marching orders and you head into battle, so to speak, with this fire that is 200 feet above the tree line?
Right. It changes over time. So we have what we call initial attack. The first in crews, obviously, they're not getting a plan that says this is what we're supposed to do. What they operate off is what we call that leader's intent, commander's intent. They know, obviously, the goal is to prevent harm to life and try to preserve property. So they will just take a piece of dirt, if you will, and start doing their job within an area until this command structure grows. So an incident commander or this unified command, as it grows, they can't reach out to everybody. It becomes beyond the span of control. So in the military world, in the fire world, in fact, a lot of studies have been done on this. They have come to some type of agreement that a person really can't handle more than six different objectives or six different resources that have different missions. And it really depends on the criticality of what the task is. So because of that, we break down our units into these tangible groups where our resources, where we don't go beyond the span of control. So in the command structure, we have basically five different groups. So you have the incident commander, and below him is his command staff. So the part of that group is a public information officer, a safety officer, or a group of safety officers. And those people report directly to the incident commander under his or her tutelage and kind of gives them. So the public information, the safety officer, and forgive me, I just forgot. I should know.
Communications officer?
No. Not comms. So then underneath that is the general command staff, which would be a finance group that tracks every penny that's being spent on the fire.
Because there's a whole lot of chargebacks that need to happen, right?
There's
because
millions and millions and millions of dollars that's going to get charged, yes.
If I'm Central Fire or Santa Cruz Fire and I have two crews that go off to this thing,
right?
somebody's going to send me some money to pay for these crews.
City of Santa Cruz is going to get reimbursed when they come back for sending their people up there.
By the state?
By the state or by the federal agency, depend on who is responsible for it. And in this case, where it's in this paradise area, we'll get money through the federal government in return. And so that will be part of it. And I liaison is the other part of that. I should have remembered liaison. And I'll explain a little bit how that works.
What would this fire cost at the when this campfire is finally done? What's the range of what this is going to cost the American taxpayer?
I would hate to even guess, because we've never suffered this type of loss of life. And structures in any fire we've ever had. You know, we're looking at structures loss that we've never experienced before. So when you look at loss to insurance companies and the resources that's used up there, it's going to be in the billions. It's going to be just astronomical. I couldn't even fathom to guess what it's going to be. Way beyond comprehension. When you consider,
it's like a small war we're fighting.
It actually is, and it's done over such a small period of time with so many resources. It's crazy that we can even get out there and do it. In my mind, having been involved in these fires for many, many years, I'm still amazed at what we're able to accomplish. And if people could go up and experience, you know, it's a loss for a lot of individuals, and we've lost, look at the life we lost in this. We're up to 80 something already now.
And the number of missing, and I realize not all the missing are going to end up dead, but some horrible percentage of them will. I mean,
absolutely. And some may never be found, right?
The number is the number's shocking at 80, and it's going to go up.
Right. So it's to me, it's just amazing that we can get a group of resources throughout the state and nation come together in a small to try to put a dent to hold this to a minimum. I'd hate to see what would happen if we didn't have the tools that we have and the resource availability we have to make this happen. And in many cases, it's, you know, we just try to minimize the loss, because it's beyond the firefighters' control to get in front of some of these fires. So you have the finance component. There's an operations group. Operations is the day-to-day group that goes out and runs the fire. And their goal is to look at tactically what can we do based on the resources we have, based on the weather. And so there's a bunch of different factors that come in there. And then there's the planning group. The planning group is the one that gets together and they really try to put together the information, the tools, GIS tools, mapping tools, where's the fire going, topography, so that our planning people send out different groups of people within their direction and supervision who look at the incident from on the ground. They'll go out and say, this is an area that there's a lot of residences in, so we need to hold this one steady versus, hey, there's no residents, there's no life loss in this area, so we may choose, because of the resources we have, to let that area burn. So the plans kind of put that stuff together, and then there's the logistics who kind of support the overall incident. And those are the basic components of a command team that puts together. So the state has, they've narrowed it down. When I was on a command team for 8 years with Cal Fire, and we had 10 teams at the time, now they're down to 6 teams in the whole state. So a lot of that is just because it's hard to keep the people trained at that level through attrition.
Six teams that can run a massive fire like this.
Right, through Cal Fire. So right. The feds, the Forest Service, they have a couple teams in California also. So there's more than just the Cal Fire teams, but Cal Fire is by far the largest used in the state. We call them type one teams that get used for these types of incidents.
That leadership must be exhausted now that quote unquote fire season is, I don't know, you tell me, is it 8 months of the year, 10 months of the year?
Yeah, it seems to be going further and further, right, into the year. We've spent Thanksgivings on fires before, so this time of year is not really out of the question to see these type of fires. Even up to Christmas, we've had fires depending on the weather up to that point. And because of the droughts, those heavy fuels, remember the 10,000, the timber, you know, a little bit of rain like we may be seeing this week isn't putting a dent in helping give more moisture to those type of fuels.
So when 3 inches of rain falls on a massive fire like that, it doesn't help.
It does help. It doesn't help the timber though. So if the timber is up and running, you're going to have a tough time because the fuel is so volatile and it's so dry and it's so big that it just needs to get going. The trick to it is the ladder fuel is a brush to help it get going. The rain does help that. So, you know, and now you see,
I think 3 or 6 inches of rain is not going to put out a redwood tree that is essentially a wood bomb.
Yeah. If it's a timber fire is going, it's not going to help that much to get that a little bit of rain on top of it.
Yeah.
So they bring these teams together and everyone has their role to play in trying to grow an incident so they can support an incident of that magnitude. And everyone is just, you know, they perform. It's amazing how they perform. And the thing I like about these teams, while we have certain training standards that we meet to get there, there's some mentoring that can go on, but really everyone's performing at their own level. And it's amazing to see what people step up to. And when I say that, I'm talking about firefighters. When without much direction, this whole concept of leader's intent, they can go out and do the job without a team. But to support them long term, you're going to need fuel, water, food, and the supplies to support them. So without that, they're very effective just by showing up on this initial attack to fight fires.
And so maybe let's go to, you know, where you spent a lot of your focus, which is on the logistics of putting up a operation that can support 1,000 to 5,000 firefighters in, you tell me, if we have a fire like this back when you were doing this before you retired, how long would it take you to put together a city and the supply lines? And you tell me all the things that need to happen to make sure that 5,000 firefighters can do their job and what you do to do make that happen.
Yeah, so there's some great tools available to us. And, you know, I did logistics for CAL FIRE team for 8 years. The first two incidents I went to as a deputy logistics, and I'll go back to the Oakland Hills fire I was talking about. That was such a problem because we got the resources there, we just couldn't support them. And so the Office of Emergency Service from California decided they were going to put together their own command teams to help run these fires within the cities. But because CAL FIRE already had them up and running, they negotiated with the state to say, Office of Emergency Service, to say, don't go out and create new teams because we really don't have enough call volume to keep everyone trained to be efficient at the job. We'll just add local government people to our teams so that they're trained also. So that's how I got on. I had, a friend who was an incident commander of a team who brought me on and put me in this logistics position. And it's not a very sexy position, to be honest with you, because everyone wants to be fighting the fire, doing the tactical part, right? So, but I couldn't turn down the offer. It was a great offer.
But somebody's got to run the operation that enables it, right?
And, yeah, you just want somebody else to do it. You want to go fight fire. So, anyways, I was very fortunate to be asked to be part of this logistics staff. And then after the second incident of me going out, the first one was up in the middle of Timbuktu, just grass, pasture land, which is all important. But that was the first one. The second one was at a butte complex, just like this one. It's called the Butte Complex in 1997, I believe it was. So it was the same area that this one was run. And it was a series of lightning strikes that caused the fires. Again, drought situation, so we had a lot of timber fires. And I was a deputy logistics on that one. Well, right after that incident, they termed out the logistics chief, and they put me in that position, which I didn't think I was prepared for. So I spent the remaining 8 years I was on a team doing that job, and it was really very satisfying. Not because... logistics has a big role to support the incident. Otherwise, it's not going to be able to accomplish their goals, right? If you don't have fuel, if you don't have hose and your resources, don't feed your people.
And you've got to do everything from all of the tools and technologies required to fight the fire,
right,
to the food, Do you build tent cities?
Yeah, we literally built a city. So typically what we do is we use a lot of the fairgrounds. The Chico Fairgrounds is what we use in the Butte Complex. And so you have an infrastructure to work from. Or sometimes we'll use campgrounds. We've used just tent buildings. We'll use whatever we can find as far as infrastructure.
And you got to bring in Johnny on the spots. And you got to build a city in a campground or in a fairground for 5,000 firefighters.
Within hours. So literally we can feed, well, at a minimum, 3,000 firefighters within 5 to 8 hours, steaks, and have them a hot cooked meal. Up until that time, till we get them cooked meals, you know, we can have bag lunches and bag meals or MREs if we have to, because they're already ready for us. But we try by the first operational period to have, you know, hot cooked meals. They're working very hard out there. Obviously, they need it to maintain their health and the energy that we expect them to use out there.
This may be a silly question, but it's on my mind. If I'm one of those firefighters, am I allowed to have a beer at the end of the day with my steak?
Yeah, that's a good question. And maybe this would be good education even for some of our firefighters. The answer is no.
That's what I figured.
So for those of us...
Boy, I bet you want one, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's some good stories about this.
I might even drink a Heineken.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that we still battle in every incident. But the reality is this. We're not allowed to drink on duty.
Yeah, of course.
We're on duty from the time we leave until the time we get home. Now, the interesting part is we give time off for these people. They obviously can't just go. The first 24, 36 hours, everyone's working hard. There's no breaks for anybody.
So for 24 hours, 36 hours as a firefighter, or you as the head of logistics or anybody else on this fire, we probably work those 36 hours straight.
Yeah. And you may take a cat nap somewhere. But everyone's working. There's no breaks to ramp up on an incident. But once we get to a level where, like, they've been operating now for the last couple of weeks, the campfire, we have either 12-hour shifts or 24-hour shifts. If it's a CAL FIRE, they usually like to do 24-hour shifts. So meaning your engine gets an assignment, they work that assignment for 24 hours, and then they get 24 hours off. And we try to give them a decent place to rest and relax so they're
But they don't go home. They go to TJ's campground.
Exactly. And if they're lucky, they may get a hotel room, but... they're going to be housed somewhere. But even on that 24 hours off, you're not off duty, meaning you can't have a beer, even though it's your, quote, day off the fire. So that's where we run into a little bit of troubles with people who don't understand the system, because it's easy to do when you're housed and you're going to restaurants for dinner.
Sure.
And outside the area. So, yeah, it's always tempting. And we still have to, you know, police those issues.
So you got to wait till the fire's out before you can have a beer.
You have to wait till you get home and punch out and you're on your own day off at home. Then you can have your beers. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's a motivator to put the fire out.
Yeah. You know, it's a crazy time in our world because of things happening. There's a lot of these questions that come up that we haven't really, we know the answers, I think, but I don't know that we've actually have policies for now. Like, marijuana is legal now, right? Recreational marijuana.
Yeah.
These edibles are legal, right? Well, how do you monitor that? And if you guys are, it's no different than
So do we have alcohol. A Cheech and Chong fighting fires?
Well, let's hope not. But it's just another thing that you kind of got to watch sure. out there. So, yeah.
And what's it like to be like a frontline woman or man on these strike teams, on these engines, fighting a fire like this, working a 24-hour shift?
Yeah, it can be completely exhausting, way beyond people's mindset.
I mean, you've got what, about 40 pounds of equipment? Or tell me what's on your person.
Yeah, it depends on what your assignment is, but up to 70 pounds. So we wear protective clothing, which, you know, in itself is not really heavy, but where we run into problems is heat-related injuries, because now you have to be completely covered with a Nomex material. Typically, they like you to be double layered. In other words, you mean a t-shirt underneath your Nomex. You know, some people wear long pants or just shorts under their Nomex pants. You have boots, you have a hood shroud on, you have gloves on. You don't get a lot. Your body doesn't really get a chance to breathe. And then typically in these fires.
And are you sweating like crazy in this outfit?
You're sweating profusely
Are you wet? Like, are you soaking wet?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why we take, you know, multiple t-shirts and you try to change your undergarments. But You know, in the weather of wildland fires, typically it's 80, 90, 100 plus degrees out there. And so we have to keep
and a close eye. And you're in a spacesuit.
Exactly. Yeah.
The other thing I found incredible is just shows you how naive I am. But of course, in a wildfire situation, you don't have oxygen.
Yeah, we don't carry oxygen. I mean, some of our engines have SCBAs where you could put tanks on, but that's really not the place for it because it's going to last a short period of time. So
you're breathing all of this toxic air.
Right, and there's different standards on that. They make these little pocket masks that have like pellets in them that kind of cut the smoke, the particles out. A lot of guys use bandanas, but then some agencies don't allow even bandanas on the face because they're afraid that if it gets moist or wet from your workout, then you may get heated steam into your lungs, believe it or not, just from the bandana. So everyone's got their own different policies on that.
So some gals and guys are just nothing on their mouth and nose, and they're just breathing that toxic air in.
Yeah, our face shroud covers your mouth, and then you have goggles on. So you really have you shouldn't have any unprotected skin. It should all be covered. But it does, it limits your ability to breathe. It's hot, it's smoky, it's not ideal conditions. And then you add the heat and all the gear you're carrying. If they're putting stringing hose out, we call it plumbing the line, you're gonna have another 75 pounds or so on your back that you're carrying. So you have we all carry web gear, which has got a radio on it. We have water.
Does every firefighter have a radio?
Well, it depends on the agent. It's agency driven, so you don't know if they're coming from all these different agencies, but we really encourage every firefighter to have a radio. And you can check out radios at the camp when you get there if you need them, so that every firefighter does have a radio.
So you, as the head of logistics, you're bringing
that's a logistics thing.
Radios. Yeah,
we bring out a whole comm center. So in the 1997 Butte Complex fire, there's been actually another one in between them. So Butte burns every now and then. It's not uncommon for the fire up there. But the whole 911 system went down for Butte County, and we actually ran the initial dispatch 911 system right out of our incident base from a trailer. And we actually brought out local government from Santa Clara, San Jose, real-life dispatchers to come up there and work in the wildland. And when you dial 911, you got them. And so if you're having a medical in a town around the fire, it was still coming through our incident base there. It's pretty crazy what you can accomplish up there. A lot of tools available to us.
And remind me, TJ, how long have you been retired now?
5 years.
5 years.
Yeah, coming up on 5 years.
And so what's it like for you now to, you know, be sitting at home and turn on the news and see these huge fires, and whether it's Malibu or this Butte campfire, and you know exactly what's going on. I mean, that's what you did for so many years and at a very senior level. What's it like as private citizen,
right,
TJ Welsh, to see this going on?
Yeah, it's tough because probably the biggest struggle with retirement is missing the ability to challenge your mind and try to look at how you're going to attack these type of problems. I appreciated that in my job more than anything was the challenge of what was presented to you. These guys,
like how do we put up a city for 5,000 people in 3 hours
and really,
or less?
And really, that's almost becomes automatic because we have a lot of good players, right? We have contracts, we have people that come out. So like the kitchens are going to feed the people that our prisons actually run, the inmates run these kitchens that come out and cook for our folks.
What?
Yeah. Actually, our prisoners do amazing and they take so much pride in their work. So they wear...
So the prisoners are feeding the firefighters?
Yes. They're the chefs. So we get the food.
Now I got to believe this is not, you know, this is not Manson doing this, right?
Yeah, no. You know, it's changed over the years. In fact, I guess the way they rate inmates, there's some rating system from the Manson type down to the type that was maybe selling drugs on the street. And so our governor lowered that standard to get some of these drug people that are not, he considered harmless, out of the prisons and back on the street because our prisons are overcrowded. So that brought a higher tier of inmate,
a felon.
Yeah,
a more.
Well, they're all felons, I guess. Yeah, but to be part of these teams, you have to be shown that you're going to be trustworthy, and you know, I guess every now and then one goes AWOL. But my years of experience with them, they were all above reproach. Just they did phenomenal jobs.
So a local warden, mm-hmm. in concert with you,
right,
mobilizes. Let's say for this campfire, how many inmates would be there?
As soon as I would get a call for like the campfire,
yeah.
Let's say it's day one, day two, and they're going, okay, this thing is, it's going to be a big fire. It's going to take off. And our team would get a phone call. So my incident commander would just send me an email or text saying, oh, we're heading to this fire. Now, most of us are already in tune of what's going on. Are we going or not going? What team is up? And so on. So as soon as I get the call, then I place all my orders. I start talking about, I need an MKU, I need the food order sent out, and we call it a short list. I'd make that phone call immediately before I even leave to go to the incident. So by
And just like your incident commander counts on you, you count on all your direct reports too. Hey, we're going.
Right.
They know what to do. They have their right. punch list. They're trained.
Right. Expectations are pretty high, but the great thing about this, I don't know if you've ever looked, MIT did a study a number of years ago on what really motivates people outside of a mechanical type task. And it's pretty amazing that they looked at it. Three major things they found motivate people. One is autonomy, being able to operate at your own level. Secondly was mastery of the skill. People who were given that latitude wanted to master their own skill, maybe even way beyond what the expectation was. And the third part was a sense of purpose. So that's what's great about these teams. And I wish everybody could be part of a team like this, because it was probably the biggest growth for me as a manager, as a chief officer, not just from a standpoint of technical things, but as a person of leadership, to learn how to let other people do their job, and they will almost always surprise you and act way beyond your expectations. And that's what happens even with these camps. So these are with these MKUs that are inmates. They show up. These guys have full dress chef gear on. I mean, they have towels over their arms. I mean, they want to provide a great level of service to the firefighters. Wow. And
how many inmates would be at a fire like the campfire?
Oh, man. I bet there's... we run out of crews pretty quick, because I think Cal Fire tries to keep 1,700 inmates ready to go to fires at any given time. But beyond that, then you have other crews that come from different organizations. There's female inmate crews that come out. There's youth authority crews that come out, young inmates that come out. And then we start get into other types of hand crews and stuff that come out. But
yeah.
There's a minimum of, you know, there's probably a couple thousand out right now.
Wow.
So
incredible.
Pretty crazy. And they all...
So we owe those inmates a debt of gratitude to thank those inmates for supporting our firefighters.
You know, just as a side note, I now that I'm retired, I have a couple jobs I do, but one of them is I work for the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, and I investigate firefighter fatalities. So if a firefighter dies in the line of duty, they're investigated, and Congress enacted this in 1998. So I'm just now finishing my first one, and it happened to be an inmate firefighter. But the interesting thing talking with I just spent this last week talking with the
inmate. And this is, to be clear, this is an inmate who is trained to fight fires
right.
outside of the prison.
Right.
And a fire like this Butte fire goes down, and this inmate is shoulder to shoulder with the women and men who maybe work.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're respected out there.
And can they get a job when they get out as a firefighter?
Well, I think the tough part for them is because they're felons, the medical side of the world doesn't really allow you to be a felon and become a medical.
Like an EMT or like something like that.
Like an EMT or paramedic. So I think that's a struggle with them. I would hope so. The people that I've just been working with are phenomenal. I mean, these guys train... I would hate to say much harder. They're a captive audience, right?
Yeah.
So literally. these guys are telling me their schedule. They get up at 3:30 in the morning. They start their first workout at 3:30 in the morning. They come back to the firehouse, or in the firehouse, they eat about 5:30 in the morning. They have their breakfast. Then they do all their chores around the firehouse. And then they do some training, and then they go out for their second workout. So they work out twice a day. And so they work very hard.
They're like professional athletes.
They are. And they work very hard at doing that. And when I was talking to them, the ones I spoke to realized that they owed society a debt because they had made mistakes. But in giving that, you know, you would hope at some point this rehab would actually work and they could actually, you know, be able to go back and do something.
Work as firefighters.
Get outside. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I was pretty impressed with them. But that's why you notice on these large wildland fires, everybody's given 110%, and you know, the autonomy that they're given, one, because you can't manage all that those resources, allows them to work beyond our expectations. And there's so many stories that come out of these incidents, whether it's a individual. I was speaking to you about one of the first fires I went to, and as a strike team leader, and the engines were all spread out, and it wasn't until after the timber fire was out that we could check on them. The dialogue between the homeowners, where I had them all in a little housing area I shouldn't say housing area, it was one little tiny ranch house, rural house. I had 27 residents, 10 dogs, because it was the only piece of green grass in the whole timber forest. But the relationships that you build with these people is amazing. So think about the thousands of people up there in campfire right now. They're relying on these individuals to save their homes. And our members in the fire service are doing a heck of a job given the circumstances that's being presented to them.
Yeah. Well, TJ, this has been a riveting conversation. Is there anything else that you would like to share about, you know, what it's like trying to fight these crazy, scary wildfires?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot to talk about. I think the biggest thing is and I hate to say it because I was a firefighter, that we owe our firefighters anything, but this is what they get paid for, and I think they do a heck of a job. They do a phenomenal job for those. They take it very seriously, what they're being presented with, and it's a struggling time. And the unfortunate part is we get caught into a lot of politics and in the world about, you know, who's at fault for something like this campfire. And the loss to the human life is just something that is hard for anybody really to grasp in that situation. And I don't know where we're getting. Like, I love to see the community outreach that we've seen, even from Santa Cruz. You yourself have been helping out. And that's amazing. If we could live in that little world of saying, how can I help? And all the other attributes of life, we'd be a lot further along, I think.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's been really incredibly, it sounds so trite, but it's been really moving to me to see our little town of Santa Cruz and, you know, one of the retailers here, a store on the west side that we like called Sawyer, they sell all this. You've been over there, yeah, right. You know, and it's run by a wonderful gal. And you know, so she just organized, she had an employee who grew up in the area, and she just rented a truck and sent out an email list to all the Sawyer customers and said, hey, we're organizing a truck. This is what the various authorities have told us people want and need. Please come and support us. And, you know, Carrie and I went out there and we saw them loading the truck, and we had sat down. Carrie went and got all these Target gift cards.
Oh, great.
And then, you know, Carrie being Carrie, she got cards with little notes. And we sat down, her and myself, and our 16, 14, and 10-year-old two nephews and the young ones and niece. And we all sat there, and we wrote little love notes to these people.
That's awesome.
And we asked the kids to sign their names and give their ages so they understood who was sending them this note. And, you know, we looked at these beautiful things that these kids wrote, saying that, you know, we hope that you know, as the smoke clears, your life gets better, and just want you to know that there's people in Santa Cruz thinking about you, and we're sending our love. And like, I'm sitting there writing these notes with these children, and I'm like, my eyes are all watered up. And, yeah. And then, you know, you get over to Sawyer and you see all these people contributing, and Stacy, the owner there, and all that stuff, right? And that's just our own little community. And it, so it really is heartwarming. And look, I'll say it. I think what you guys do, I think you guys are superheroes.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate it. I think firefighters get a lot of credit. The reality is what you guys just did for that community can't be taken away, because these folks have nothing now. Literally, they and if you look at the socioeconomic area we're talking about, they didn't have much to begin with.
Right.
So when you're talking about taking away their home and their belongings,
so many of them don't have insurance.
Yeah, where do they go from here? So it's the outpouring support from folks like yourself and the communities like that that's going to get these people through the process. That's for sure.
Well, TJ, I can't thank you for this time enough. I've been wanting to sit down with you for a long time. I hope we get to do it again, where we can unpack your career and hopefully that of Chris Haas's as well, because I think that's another fascinating conversation to have.
Yeah.
But you have a unique insight into these wildfires, and I can't thank you enough for sharing it with me.
Well, thanks. I was very fortunate that I was allowed some opportunities to give me some of that insight, and really it's made me a grateful person for the community to see the outpouring support when these type of events happen. So thank you.
They don't make better men than you.
Well, you're being too nice. Thank you.
Thanks, TJ. Whew. What a conversation. You know, I've spent a ton of time with TJ. We've become friends over the last several years. He's my muscle car buddy. We learned to become race car drivers together. And I got to tell you, I don't know a better person than TJ Welsh. And knowing him and another good friend who's also a retired fire chief has given me a much deeper appreciation for the women and men who put their lives on the line to save our lives. If you know somebody who would be inspired and motivated by this conversation, why not email it to them right now? And make no mistake, the biggest compliment you can give me and everybody involved with this podcast is to share it on social media. Now, are you a nonprofit? NetSuite wants to help you make a difference. The NetSuite Social Impact Program is designed to help nonprofits and social enterprises of all sizes quickly take advantage of the latest cloud technologies to make the world a different place. For qualified nonprofits, NetSuite is offering their business management software in the cloud at no cost. So go to netsuite.com and look for the NetSuite Social Impact Program. And if you're a profit-making business, NetSuite wants to help turbocharge your growth. You know, we did not want our founding sponsor to be the maker of cat beds. By the way, I heard recently there's a guy, this is on another podcast, this is a bit of a rabbit hole, but there's a guy who likes sleeping in a cat bed. I don't know. People are mental, but I digress. That's not what we were looking for. NetSuite shares our passion for helping entrepreneurs be successful and grow their business. And they are offering you, a listener to this podcast, a free 1-hour growth review with an expert in your industry. That's why I want you to go check out netsuite.com/different, and you can set up time to do that. NetSuite powers the growth of over 40,000 companies in industries as diverse as marketing and advertising, consulting, energy, financial services, manufacturing, software, and more. So NetSuite has a solution for you, and you can begin your journey at netsuite.com/different. Also, we're doing more Q&A shows. So if you want to ask me a question, fire off an email to blackhole, all one word, at lockhead.com, LOCHHEAD. You can follow me on Twitter at Lockhead. And if you want to stay up to date, you want to build a direct relationship with us, while you're at lockhead.com, hit that subscribe button, and we'll get you on our email list and keep you up to date with everything we have going on. All right. We would like to thank the incredible men and women, the true heroes in our world, the firefighters who put their lives at risk to save our lives. Thank you so much. Amazon number one bestseller, Niche Down, How to Become Legendary by Being Different. OneLifeFullyLived.org, dream, plan, and live your best life. We are the nonprofit helping you build a solid financial foundation and build your life on top of it. Check it out, onelifefullylived.org. John's Crazy Socks, the official sock supplier to follow your different. Pick up a couple thousand pairs at johnscrazysocks.com. Now, is it time for an assistant? Are you in over your head? Could you use a little bit of help? Maybe you don't want to do all that stuff by yourself. Check out Bottleneck Virtual Assistants at bottleneck.online. And don't forget, when you're on lockhead.com, search TJ Welsh, W-E-L-C-H, to check out the show notes for this episode. And there, you will find a series of links for how you can make donations to the California wildfire victims. Do what I've done. Crack open your wallet, crack open your credit card, and do what you can. All right, we need to remind you that this oddcast is the sole property of the Lockhead Oddcast Network, and we would love you just a little bit extra if you shared the shit out of it. All rights do remain disturbed. We must warn you that this oddcast is clearly produced in a studio that does contain nuts. The creators of this podcast may have been consuming libations. Don't forget, teach CPR, and if you don't know CPR, take a CPR course. Support your local firefighters. Remember to save water and shower with a friend. Don't fry bacon in the nude. And if you haven't changed your mind lately, how do you know you have one? Thank you, Dandy Candy. I love you, Mom and Dad. And hey, Colin, this oddcast really ties the room together, doesn't it? Today, our deepest apologies go out to Doug Parker, CEO of American Airlines. Sorry, Dougie, we just ran out of time for you. That's it. Thank you so much for investing some of your life with me. Stay legendary, and don't forget to follow your different.